From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In his first words as President of the United States, as if still on the campaign trail, Donald Trump described a country in ruins.
Mothers and children trapped in poverty in our inner cities. Rusted out factories scattered like tombstones across the landscape of our nation.
Even Trump's optimistic plans for redeveloping our hellscape were rife with darkness and foreboding.
We assembled here today are issuing a new decree to be heard in every city, in every foreign capital, and in every hall of power. From this day forward, a new vision will govern our land. From this day forward, it's going to be only America first. America first.
A decree, he said. Democracy has no decrees. America first, he said, echoing the isolationist and fascism-friendly movement of the early 40s. Ladies and gentlemen, Elvis has left the building. On Friday, opened a new act. It's billed as patriotic, whether also lawful and democratic, remains unanswered.
Even as President Trump intoned those words from the podium, the WhiteHouse.gov website was being populated by a half dozen top priorities. First, to eliminate the government's climate action plan and revive the coal industry. Second, to defeat ISIS and rebuild our military. Third, to create jobs by cutting taxes and regulation. Fourth, to rebuild the military. I know, that was also number two. Fifth, to reduce crime by supporting gun rights and building a border wall. And sixth, to pull out or renegotiate our trade deals. No surprises there. No specifics either. What is a little surprising is that a show called On the Media hasn't yet focused on what President Trump's loathing of the media means for journalism. Time's a-wasting, so we'll start by recalling his slapdown of CNN at last week's press conference.
You are attacking our news organization. Can you give us a chance?
Your organization.
You are attacking
terrible.
Our news organization.
The media were none too happy with the experience, and apparently neither was the president-elect.
Trump threatened a blow to the White House press corps.
Thank you very much.
Maybe moving the briefings and maybe journalists' workspace across the street.
They are the opposition party. I want them out of the building. We are taking back the press room. That's a quote from a report in Esquire magazine.
Is he going to move them to the EOB from the press room?
He sure is. Absolutely.
Is he really?
Is that right? That's,
wow.
That's big.
Shocking. Until a few days later, at least, when Trump declared that, out of the goodness of his heart, he would allow the press to remain where they are, for now. But if he were to move the press corps, would it be as shocking as it's been portrayed? Time magazine's Olivia Waxman says, meh. With the help of the Time archive, Waxman traced the path of the White House press and found that it never did run smooth. Olivia, welcome to OTM.
Thanks for having me.
Take us back to the very beginning. What was the press-government relationship at the founding of the country?
Journalists were not allowed to attend the Constitutional Convention, nor were they allowed in early state legislatures or the Continental Congress. Actually, a gossip columnist named Anne Royale literally had to steal John Quincy Adams' clothes to get him to grant her an interview. She sat on his clothes on the bank of the Potomac until the bathing president granted her an interview.
Was there anything that really jumped out at you as surprising when you went through the archive of Time magazine?
Well, I was surprised that women had been the first to argue that everything in the White House should be public knowledge because taxpayers paid for its upkeep.
Emily Briggs of Philadelphia.
She said, "When we go to the executive mansion, we go to our own house. We recline on our own satin and ebony."
And then we get to President Grover Cleveland. And you say that's when we begin to see the emergence of the White House reporter that we'd recognize today.
Right. So there's a historian named Martha Kumar who pinpoints it to Fatty Price of the Washington Evening Star. He was one of the first reporters to work the White House beat. He sat at a table in a hallway and would pepper people with questions who were walking by. Martha Kumar found a letter that Thady Price had written, a White House staff member saying, thank you for the tablecloth. So that seems to be the first sign we have that reporters were camped out, so to speak.
We're talking there the 1880s, 1890s. You get to the 1900s, to Teddy Roosevelt, who really loved reporters.
Yes, he had a sort of newspaper cabinet that typically would meet with him during Roosevelt's early afternoon shave. And if you can imagine, reporters got that kind of access in the early 20th century. Enviable now. But Teddy Roosevelt did banish reporters to what he called the Aeneas Club if the stories proved to be embarrassing for the president. And Fortune magazine reported that the journalists would readily forgive him because he made, quote, such astounding copy.
Roosevelt had his favorites, whereas President Wilson seemed to open up his doors to a wide range of reporters, a lot of people, less intimacy.
Yes. Wilson's private secretary, Joseph Tumulty, told reporters that the president would, quote, look them in the face and chat with them for a few minutes. Mm-hmm. So on March 15, 1913, 125 newspaper staffers showed up, and Wilson said, your numbers forced me to make a speech to you en masse instead of chatting with each of you as I had hoped to do, and thus getting greater pleasure and personal acquaintance out of this meeting.
Now, FDR, like his relative Teddy Roosevelt, was catnip for the press. He gave, you write, nearly 1,000 press conferences almost twice a week.
Time reported that he kept most White House news hawks fluttering happily. Those press conferences were ones where they had a real exchange of information. It was being compared to Prime Minister's Question Time in the UK. But he also locked the doors so no reporters could walk out.
Of the press room?
Yes. On occasion, he would call correspondents liars or tell them to put on dunce caps.
Really? I guess it's okay to call a particular correspondent a liar if it's not being televised. But that's when the next big change happened, under Eisenhower.
That's a watershed moment. James Hagerty, Eisenhower's press secretary, had been on the campaign trail. He had worked with the press corps before. He knew what a difference the press made. So January 1955 was the first televised news conference.
With the president.
Yes.
Well, I see we're trying a new experiment this morning. I hope it doesn't prove to be a disturbing influence.
Well, tomorrow, the second anniversary of your inauguration, I wonder if you'd care to give us an appraisal of your first 2 years and tell us something of your hopes for the next two or maybe even the next six.
Looks like a loaded question.
They were thinking about it in the same way that Trump thinks about Twitter. This is our chance to get to the public directly, to be seen by the public directly.
But Hagerty edited the thing. It wasn't in the control of any TV network.
Right. And the New York Post was surprised at how scripted this was. I'll quote from that article. What is most notable in all the comment is the absence of protest over the censorship imposed by the White House, a censorship which the networks have supinely accepted. Thus, after Wednesday's conference, Hagerty deleted 11 of the 27 questions and answers before letting the show go on the road. For example, when asked about his delay in the reappointment of Ewan Clegg as Commissioner of Labor Statistics, the president confessed he had never heard of the fellow.
Now, when you described LBJ's relationship to the press, in a way it kind of reminded me of Teddy Roosevelt's shaving. And you note that Johnson was pretty unceremonious as well.
Oh, yes. A White House reporter said that he once answered reporters' questions about the economy aboard Air Force One while stripping down until he was standing buck naked and waving his towel for emphasis. Johnson just didn't have any boundaries, apparently.
So bringing us closer to what's probably the Trump mindset, it was President Nixon who gave the press corps their current home. But he wasn't thereby doing the press any big favor, right?
Right. He wanted to keep presidential visitors and White House staff away from reporters. To designate a briefing room by putting a floor over the White House swimming pool. And when it opened in 1970, the Washington Post said it looked like the lobby of a fake Elizabethan steakhouse when the stage is hidden behind the curtains. And Ronald Reagan's press secretary, James S. Brady, for whom the briefing room is named, used to joke that he and Reagan always planned on installing a trap door so reporters who got out of line would fall into the swimming pool if he pushed a button on his podium.
In tracking the changes over centuries, do you notice a general trend?
Presidents may tweak the format of things as they come into office, but there were questions when Eisenhower came in whether to keep reporters in the White House. And Nixon thought about not having a press secretary at one point, but ultimately what happens is that presidents and their staff recognize that having 100 reporters and TV cameras and photographers in one place, this is a great resource. My favorite quote about precedents these days is from a special assistant to Calvin Coolidge, who said that if you can get the president to do a thing twice in a row, then every other president will do it.
I think the same could probably be said of the White House press corps. Olivia, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Olivia Waxman writes for Time magazine, even though Trump eventually backed down, the press is still facing an uncertain future under a president openly hostile to the mainstream media. And when he gave his final press conference this week, President Obama addressed that anxiety.
That's the point of this relationship. You're not supposed to be sycophants. You're supposed to be skeptics. You're supposed to ask me tough questions. You're not supposed to be complimentary. But you're supposed to cast a critical eye on folks who hold enormous power. And having you in this building has made this place work better.
About that last part, what if being effective skeptics and helping our democracy means getting out of the White House? Writing in Pointer this week, Benjamin Mullen pointed out that virtually no landmark stories have ever emerged from the White House press corps. Reporter Anna Marie Cox wrote in 2009 that it was more often where news goes to die. In 2014, reporter Glenn Thrush said that it was like covering a horse race from inside a horse. And according to Reed Cherlin, who was an assistant press secretary under President Obama, it's none too pleasant from the other side either.
Well, because it takes place in this room you're so used to seeing on TV, it has an air of importance around it, and it's exciting. Everybody really respects it as a tradition. But it ends up feeling often like a chore, or it did when I worked there. And I want to stipulate that this was years ago. This is the first 2 years of President Obama's term.
And I'm sure things have radically changed since then.
Yeah, right. It's gotten much better. They've totally reinvented it. The truth is the format hasn't changed since the 90s, really. The two rules would be don't lie and make no news. It was part of my job as a young person in the press office to help then Press Secretary Robert Gibbs and then Jay Carney prepare for the briefing every day. So we would put together a briefing book that had tabs for different topics we expected questions on. Each of those pages in that book would have an affirmative statement at the top of what our main point would be. It also had Q&A bullet points underneath for if we got pressed. But really, there weren't a lot of circumstances under which the press secretary was going to go farther than what was written on that page.
I guess the question is, how substantive is the stuff on that page? Yahoo News wrote an article in 2013 called The Top 9,486 Ways Jay Carney Won't Answer Your Questions. Why can't this be a forum for actually answering questions? What is inherent in the way these proceedings are structured that makes that almost impossible?
The sort of dark secret of Washington is that most days are slow news days. Without question, there are a lot of days when something big is happening, and I don't think anyone would argue that briefings should never happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's that the briefing happens by default every day, and when you put it on TV, it has the effect of making everyone a character. I spoke to Mike McCurry, press secretary under President Clinton, as I was doing research, and he talked about the first time that the reverse shot was allowed in the briefing room. The reporter asked, and I believe it was Scott Pelley of CBS, who was then a White House correspondent, can we put a camera up on the dais so that it shoots me asking the question? McCurry described that moment as everything feeling like it changed, because then everybody wanted to get the reverse shot. This isn't the main problem with the briefing, but it is a problem with the briefing. The first row of reporters, which includes most of the TV network reporters, they ask the same question because they all want to get the tape for their package that evening. So you basically have the same question being asked 8 times in a row, which takes up a lot of time. And by the time you get to the second row, third row, people more print-focused who aren't, you know, really trying to get sometimes more nuanced information, the mood is already soured. People are annoyed. Everybody's bored.
Another interesting point, it really would undermine the camaraderie of the press corps. We noted last week that when Jim Acosta of CNN was shut down by Trump, the rest of the press corps did not pick up his question and run to his defense. They, as Bob said, ran over his body instead to get their question answered. And right. As you've noted, on the campaign trail or at an event, reporters are more likely to informally compare notes, chat, maybe collude in the best possible sense, and put the TV in there and games off.
Right. I mean, I don't want to overstate that. And I do think in the White House briefing, you do have a lot of reporters following off of each other's questions and sort of hunting as a pack, which can often be the best way to get answers out of a spokesperson who doesn't want to say much. But I do think it erodes the camaraderie a bit. I mean, I think the first thing is everybody wants it to be productive. I think everyone ends up feeling disappointed. It's a bad system, and you end up getting bad outcomes, and you even end up getting bad behavior. Imagine if you were having a fight or a tense conversation about disclosure of information with your spouse. There was some new information introduced in your relationship that you needed to discuss. And you said, I want to put a TV camera on both of us, and then we're going to put this in the newspaper. You can just imagine how you would start to talk differently.
That is the worst analogy in the history of analogies, Reed, because the nature of an intimate relationship is completely different from that of an accountable government to its citizenry.
Right. But I think what you're forgetting is the human element, which is that unlike any other press job in Washington, and again, this was how it worked when I was there, and the Trump team has been talking about potentially fiddling with this, unlike any other press job in Washington where you can avoid a reporter's phone call if you want, in the White House, you can't, because the reporters are allowed to roam from the briefing room into the West Wing press offices. They can go right up to your desk and they can sit down and wait for you to get off the phone and talk to them. So there's really no way to hide from each other. And on days when, let's say, you have the intention of making the announcement that everyone's anticipating, but it's not quite ready, and you're just trying to buy yourself time to get all the facts right, but you've got 10 reporters charging up from the briefing room, standing over your desk saying, we need this information now, where Reuters is saying this and we have to match it, it can be really tense. It also can become a personal standoff kind of an issue where you can be working with a reporter who you feel like is treating you unfairly. As a reporter, you can be working with a spokesman who you think is serially withholding. Often the worst of those relationships then gets highlighted in the briefing room on television. That's very inside baseball, but it's a big reason why the briefing can feel frustrating and a little bit pointless, is because it feels like it's overtaken by squabbling. And what I would point out to you is, I know you didn't like my analogy, but there's something called a gaggle that used to happen a lot more in Washington and happens more often now when the president travels. And that is a briefing that is off camera. The press secretary answers questions, and it's not for live broadcast. It works wonders in terms of being a lot more productive and a lot faster. So people are able to ask questions earlier in the day. They're able to get a sense of what you're going to answer and what you're not. And if they know you're not going to answer a question, they can just move on to the next topic. It allows the spokesman to go on background or to say, hey, off the record, I'll have more on that for you later. Things you can't do on live television. I really do think being live is a big part of what makes the briefing a problem.
Would you prefer fewer briefings, more gaggles? I mean, as a reporter now.
One day a week, 1 week a month, there's big news happening and you really want to hear from the White House and you want it on camera and you want it live. The rest of the days when everyone knows that it's just getting an update on stuff that was in the paper that morning, you could have a gaggle take the place of that, or a different kind of exchange that we haven't tried yet.
Semaphore, smoke signals, Morse code.
Sometimes it feels like that.
You wrote back in 2013 in the New Republic that, quote, The daily briefing has become a worthless chore for reporters, an embarrassing nuisance to administration staff, and a source of added friction between the two camps. It's time to do the humane, obvious thing and get rid of it altogether.
Yeah.
What do you think now? You did write this back in 2013. Since then, we've had the first Trump press conference, which had props, a cheering section of paid staff.
I don't want to be in the position of saying, well, now that the administration's changed, my views are changing. But I do think that we're in uncharted territory in basically every element of this presidency, as far as we can tell. So we don't know yet how it's going to go.
So you no longer feel that we should consider doing away with the White House press briefing?
I'm going to respond with a talking point in the classic sense, which is my statement to you. I am for maximum accountability and transparency. Oh. If a daily briefing is the way... See, you just groaned.
Yeah, you sounded like Jay Carney.
That's exactly the effect that it has. You see what I'm saying? Exactly.
I believe in general principles, and I will not respond to the question at hand.
So that was part demonstration and part answer and part stonewalling, which is that I'm aware that you're trying to pin me to my earlier statement that I said I think the briefing should be done away with. Obviously, I'm less comfortable with that in an administration that seems to be hostile to the press. And I know that I wrote this, and I feel a little bit stung by, like, oh, man, I came out pretty strong on this, envisioning a pretty conventional string of presidencies beyond it. But, you know, if it was true then, I think it's at least partially true now that a live daily briefing isn't always very constructive and that finding new ways to communicate would be good. But I think if the idea is, well, we'll just move the press corps out of the White House, that's bad. If it's, we'll never talk to the press and we'll just tweet, that's bad. But if it's, we want to rethink the briefing and we want to have, you know, three conversations with the press corps during the day, but not all of them are on camera, something like that, I think exploring those kinds of things could be good and productive.
Reed, thank you very much.
Thank you for your tough questions and thanks for having me on.
Reed Cherlin was an assistant press secretary under President Obama and now is supervising writer for Vice News Tonight on HBO.
Coming up, so what says the president of the White House press corps?
This is On the Media.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. For the White House press corps, the Obama presidency was no day at the beach. Access to the president was more restricted than it had ever been under President Bush. It was difficult to sneak a reporter question in at a photo op. In fact, for most of Obama's 8 years, it was even hard to have a news photographer at photo ops. Mainly, the images were captured by the official White House photographer and distributed from there. So now comes Donald Trump, who takes office with no hint of peeling back the curtain. On the contrary, he's called the press slime, dishonest, crooked, and fake news purveyors. During the campaign, he sometimes banned certain major news organizations altogether. So now what? Jeff Mason, the White House correspondent for Reuters, is the president of the White House Correspondents Association, which credentials the White House press corps and press pool. Jeff, welcome to OTM.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thanks, Bob.
When the Trump administration suggested that it might be moving the press corps out of the White House, you met with Trump Press Secretary Sean Spicer and called that unacceptable. Why is it unacceptable, and what was Spicer's response?
Well, first of all, he was floating the idea of moving the briefing out of the White House press room, and that has been sort of a stalwart symbol of free press for decades and a place where White House reporters gather and ask questions of people like the press secretary, but also other senior advisors and the president himself. And so we value that space very much. Our bigger concern about that was that any sort of move out of the briefing room could be part of a larger effort that would precipitate moving the White House press corps out of the White House altogether. The good news is they've continued rethinking their plans, and his desire now is to hold his first couple briefings here in the White House briefing room, and we're supportive of that.
The White House press corps has come under criticism, including from this program, about the way it conducted business in previous administrations that in some ways had been reduced to stenographers passing on the administration's pronouncements and positions, but hadn't really broken a whole lot of stories, hadn't really penetrated as a group the White Houses of the last few administrations. Are you hopeful that that will change under the incoming administration?
Well, I disagree with the premise of your question, Bob. I think the White House Press Corps has done some terrific journalism and will continue to do so. And I think we'll have opportunities to do a lot of terrific journalism under a new administration. I think that if you look back over the last several decades, you'll see that journalism that has come from White House reporters and people who cover the White House either full-time or as part of their broader beats have led to massive stories being broken in this last several years over things like the Iran deal, over personnel. There's just a whole host of things.
President George W. Bush famously talked about avoiding the media filter and had various mechanisms for doing that. The Obama administration really did it by building up its social media operation and being very scrupulous in how it offered one-on-one access to the president. Seldom to members of the White House press corps, more often to local TV, to certain cable shows and entertainment shows and so on. Trump clearly likes to be in the spotlight. Do you think that will translate to more, not less, access to the president himself?
It's hard to say. He definitely has used Twitter, as everybody knows, as a way to get his message out. And it sounds like he's going to continue to do that when he's in the White House. But you are right to say that he's not the first to use social media. As somebody who's covered the Obama White House for 8 years, I remember us just having to adapt to that. And the press corps will adapt to the use of social media by the incoming administration as well.
What did you make, as a member of the White House press corps, of the press conference a week ago in which Trump refused to entertain a question from CNN because he was unhappy with the story that CNN reported?
I would say that the WHCA is not weighing in on who a president or the president-elect calls on at press conferences. We have a lot of members, and not all of our members get called on at those events. But the one thing that I would say with regard to that particular incident is I made clear in my meeting with Sean that the White House Correspondents Association would object to any effort to throw out a correspondent from a briefing or a press conference.
On our program last week, we imagined a scenario where the press corps, once Jim Acosta was shut down, that the press corps should be Spartacus to ask Acosta's question instead of taking the opportunity to ask their own, to make the point that you shut down one of us, you shut down all of us. Would you countenance as a press corps the Spartacus approach or anything else in which the press acts in concert in defense of its First Amendment rights?
Press corps unity is important on a lot of issues, and that's something that I've worked on as president of the association this year. But there are certainly times when unity is difficult because not only are we colleagues, we're also competitors. I think the question is, at what times is it necessary for unity to take the overarching priority, and at what times is it not? And I don't know exactly the right balance on that. I can tell you that it's hard to achieve with a lot of competing news organizations, but we're working pretty hard at it, and I think that that will be beneficial to the press corps as a group going forward in a new administration.
Jeff, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Jeff Mason, a White House correspondent for Reuters, is the president of the White House Correspondents Association.
Trump versus the media. He shuts us down. He flouts our traditions. He calls us liars. Jack Schaefer, Politico's senior media writer, thinks all of this might actually be a blessing in disguise.
It's fantastic. To quote Dashiell Hammett, I haven't heard such good news since the hogs ate my kid brother.
Okay, what's so good about it?
I think that Trump's hostility to the press and his well-advertised notion that he will not continue to do business with the press as usual sort of liberates the press, because all the old scripts that go into the formula of making political news have to be completely rethought. this gives us an opportunity to cover the White House, to quote Jay Rosen, from the outside in rather than from the inside out.
You say forget about the White House press room. It's time to circle behind enemy lines. So what does that mean?
He and his people were making noises about moving the White House press briefing room out of the White House and over into the old executive office building. And this, of course, caused the gnashing of teeth by the people who go down there and collect the sweet nothings that are whispered by the press secretary.
Even though they hate that room.
Even though they hate that room. But the people in that room would concede that very, very little real news is captured or made there. The physical dislocation of, you know, a small number of reporters, I don't care a whole lot about. I care a whole lot more about reporters digging into every department, every executive bureau, and finding real stories. And I think that they have a very good chance. The bureaucracy has been fractured. The number of people who are inside the government who might not be completely on the same page with the Trump presidency, you'd have to take off your mittens and your shoes and socks in order to count them all up. And then you'd have to multiply by a factor of 10,000. And so if you had said to me, you know, the Department of Transportation during the Obama era will be a great source for stories, I'd say, who are you kidding? No news is going to happen there. But now I think that there will be sources, whistleblowers, who will bring attention to us, the workings of the government, maybe out of their own self-interest because their status is being threatened. But, you know, a reporter takes great tips wherever he can find them.
You say the reporter should infest the departments and agencies around town that the president has peeved. Give us some examples. We know he's peeved the intelligence agencies, but, you know, where else should they infest?
Well, let's look at EPA. He is appointed as administrator of the EPA, a man who has filed suit against the EPA. It's a sure bet that inside of EPA, there are bureaucrats who won't like the new direction of the new administrator and will be very, very willing to leak or to provide information that's valuable to whatever investigation a reporter might be pursuing.
Now, what about the threat of prosecution? I mean, might even peeved members of the bureaucracy be wary of speaking to reporters? Under Obama, the Espionage Act was repeatedly invoked to go after government officials who talked to journalists about classified matters. Now, I know a lot of these stories will not be about classified matters. They could be things like simple ethics. But in some of the big scoops, you need classified material and one has to assume that Trump will really take off the gloves.
One can assume that. But if I were to put my money on the tradecraft of intelligence sources being able to cloak themselves as sources of information, I think that's a pretty solid bet. All administrations leak. The Obama administration leaked classified information all the time because it was in their interest. And we can look for the Trump team, surrogates, officials to leak on his benefit. And what that will set up is a counter-leak effort by perhaps members of the what lots of people like to call the deep state, who are threatened by, you know, these official leaks to participate with their own leaks. You know, Trump would have to be very careful there. Would he prosecute the hostile leakers, but not the friendly leakers?
Sure he would.
I don't know. I'd love to see the discovery in such a trial.
You were saying that one rich source of stories, if you're closed out of the White House press room, is peeved bureaucrats. What about opponents within the Republican Party, as well as the Democratic Party?
That's going to be a very rich avenue. You have to remember that a political party is not a monolith. John McCain, lifelong Republican, is the guy who brought the document that people are calling the dossier about Donald Trump to the attention or directed it to FBI Director Comey, which is not a friendly gesture to the incoming president. I think that presidents are always astonished that members of Congress are not robots, they're not puppets, they have a will of their own. And they're not eager to attach their fate to a president, especially a president who is this unpopular and did not win a majority of votes.
You have mentioned parallels to the Nixon administration.
Both Nixon and his leading surrogate, Spiro Agnew, were intensely hostile and critical of the press. They thought that the press had overstepped its bounds. I think that they thought that the press should just provide a stenographic exercise. Instead, the press basically threw off the complacency that maybe it had fallen into in the 50s and in the early 60s and saw Nixon's abuses of power in part because the Nixon administration was so hostile to the press. Reporters are like red ants. If you leave red ants alone, you probably have no problem. But if you kick a red ant hill, you've got a swarm of angry, biting insects. It's one thing to attack the press in the campaign stage, but now that Trump will have his hands on power, it's really at his own peril. You show me a politician who made a lifelong practice of attacking the press, you show me where those political careers end. I think they always end sort of poorly.
You think this could all not only set journalists' missions straight, but actually help revitalize the struggling industry?
I think so. Trump has driven readers and viewers to newspapers and television across the board. Wherever he goes, he makes news. But it won't always be the news that he's looking for. And wherever there's conflict, readers follow. They want to see war. They want to see conflict. They want to see bloodshed. Because that's, you know, the day-to-day experience of our life. It's war out there, Brooke.
But don't we have a more balkanized press than we ever have had in history? Aren't we all just preaching to the converted in a way that we never had before? Is there any way to persuade people who already, you know, limit their consumption to Breitbart News?
What you call balkanized, I call sort of a great flowering of the American press.
And I think it's fantastic that we have many more views out there and many more people are consuming them. The concern is that people are only consuming that which comports to their own view. So if you're doing great reporting, will it make a difference in this environment?
I think so. David Fahrenthold of the Washington Post, the man who brought us all the outrages and illegalities of the Donald Trump Foundation. David Fahrenthold is a great reporter.
For those of us who follow that sort of thing.
And what did he do? He reported the story. He reported it again. He went deeper. And the culmination is that the Donald Trump Foundation is closing up shop because he blew the whistle on them. He brought it to the attention of the public. I see the Fahrenthold example as the repudiation of your idea that people don't pay attention. Everybody paid attention to the David Fahrenthold story. Everybody paid attention when David Fahrenthold got the Access Hollywood tapes of Trump's smutty talking. I think that you're pulling my leg here, that you don't think that quality reporting that breaks big news doesn't get noticed. And then this Breitbart thing of yours is just a radio host red herring, and you think that you can get me to bite my own tail, and I will not bite my own tail.
Those were two huge stories. But the thing is that there is this feeling frequently of spitting against the wind.
You tell me, who in America was not made aware of the Access Hollywood tape?
Everybody was aware of that one. But look, it had the benefit of smutty talk. I would say many fewer people know about Fahrenthold's reporting over the Trump Foundation.
But never in the history of journalism has everybody partaken of the great scoops available to them. I think that the upside of the equation is there's this cornucopia of news and information, and it's for the sociologists and the radio talk show hosts and the marketers to
Screw
get
you,
more people to read and partake.
Well, Jack, I love being insulted by you. It's my favorite
insulting
thing.
Insulting. I take your call. I consider this the highest praise.
Jack Schaefer is Politico's senior media writer.
Coming up, Barack Obama leaves a big gift for Trump in the White House.
Enhanced surveillance powers. This is On the Media.
This is Brooke. When you've finished listening to ODM this week, why don't you head over to the New Yorker Radio Hour? David Remnick sat down with Jerry Seinfeld, who just directed his first movie about Pop-Tarts.
Did you really like Pop-Tarts all that much growing up?
Oh, yeah.
How about now?
Still, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, love them.
That's a good breakfast for you?
I eat it after a bad show on a Wednesday night.
listen to the New Yorker Radio Hour.
So do what Brooke says. Come join us for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. With Donald Trump newly inaugurated as the 45th president of the United States, he comes in riding on campaign promises to zealously protect the homeland, which he named as one of the many catastrophic incompetencies of the Obama administration.
The Obama administration, with the support of Hillary Clinton and others, has also damaged our security by restraining our intelligence gathering, and we have just no intelligence gathering information.
Well, not only did Obama nicely tidy up the White House for the new first family, he left quite a housewarming present. Under 11th-hour rule changes to Executive Order 12333, the National Security Agency has been given unprecedented power to share raw surveillance data with the 16 other government intelligence agencies. Nate Cardozo is a senior staff attorney on the Electronic Frontier Foundation's Digital Civil Liberties team. Nate, welcome to OTM.
Thanks for having me.
Order 12333, what is its significance?
So 12333 was originally enacted by President Reagan back in the 80s, and it is the authorization for the American intelligence community, which is all of our intelligence services, collection of non-U.S. person data when they want to wiretap the entire country of the Bahamas, which happened. It was done under 12333. When the NSA wanted to collect every cell phone call in Iraq and Afghanistan, it was done under Section 12333. It's very convenient in that it doesn't require any court intervention. It doesn't require any statutory basis. It has very little reporting requirements to Congress or an inspector general. The only caveat is that Americans can't be the target, supposedly, of collection under 12333. But Americans can be the target through the backdoor. This is what's called the backdoor search problem. If data is collected under 12333, Americans' names can be run through the database of that collected data without going to court and getting a warrant.
And what's changed?
Well, until this rule change went into effect, the only agency that had access to the raw, unfiltered signals intelligence collection was the National Security Agency. This is a lot of the material that we saw glimpses of in the Snowden documents. This is the sort of material that, you know, back in the old days when the NSA would tap a Soviet submarine fiber optic cable, the intelligence analyst sitting within NSA got to look at it. No one else got to see the unfiltered data. That all changes.
Now, going back to 9/11, we remember the connecting the dots problem where one agency didn't know what the other agency was doing and failed to see a terror plot hidden more or less in plain view. It seems to me that if you're looking at the glass half full, you would see this as giving the government the ability to suss out conspiracies better than it previously had, no?
Perhaps, but of course the NSA has already been permitted to share this kind of data with anyone who it deems necessary to see it. FBI, DHS, DEA have all had access to this kind of data since the collection started. Now what happens is not just the NSA, whose job it is to look it out for the national security of the United States, but also organizations like FBI or DEA, who are domestic law enforcement organizations, get to see this raw, unfiltered data, which includes collection on an unknown but massive number of Americans. This is not purely foreign intelligence information. This is information that may include my emails, your phone calls, all of our text messages, especially if they're going abroad. Depending on how the information is collected and depending on where the collection sites are, of course, all of that's top secret as well, selections of that data can now go to law enforcement without passing through NSA first, and law enforcement is free to sift through all this stuff collected without a warrant, without even a judge's signature, and look for evidence of Americans committing crimes.
Now, there is a really bizarre provision, it seems to me, in this order, and that concerns what a police agency is entitled to reveal about its source of information. It gets a hot tip from the NSA and commences an investigation, makes an arrest, but cannot cite the intelligence as probable cause for commencing the investigation. So what does that do to a legal case against a criminal defendant?
Well, it makes defending said cases quite hard. That process has a nickname in the intelligence community. It's called parallel construction. And we at the Electronic Frontier Foundation and our friends at ACLU believe that parallel construction is illegal and unconstitutional. There are documented cases of Americans who have been prosecuted based on information collected without a warrant by the NSA, and the fact that the prosecutions were based on warrantless collection was hidden not just from the defendant, but from the judges as well, at least at the beginning of these cases. A little bit of that changed after Snowden. We think that process is a blatant abuse of the NSA's collection capabilities.
Now, the Obama administration had a rather uneven record on issues of transparency and privacy, surveillance, and so forth. Mm-hmm. But I'm very curious as to what prompted it to make this rule change on the very eve of the Trump presidency.
Well, frankly, inertia. This rule change was proposed a year ago. It was first reported by Charlie Savage in the New York Times in February of 2016. And it's taken this long to get the rules finalized. My presumption was that the National Security Council and the NSA assumed that this rule change would be coming into effect as President-elect Clinton was preparing to take power. One argument that I've heard from people in the national security establishment is that civil libertarians should be happy that this rule change is going into effect now, just before Trump gets his hands on the national security community. The theory there is that this rule change is better than what Trump would have put in. That may be true, but it is cold comfort to civil libertarians like myself that this rule change is bad, but not as bad as what Trump might have otherwise done. Of course, there's nothing preventing Trump from simply making the rules even worse than they are today.
Now, you've told me about 12333 based on what you know. But you can't tell us what you don't know because portions of it are redacted.
One of the most disturbing redactions is in the list of reasons that someone can be targeted for collection under 12333. The second reason is that you're an agent of a foreign power. The third reason is that the collection might have some foreign intelligence significance. But what's the first reason? We don't know. We don't know the primary reason for targeting under this authority. We're talking about how much data this is potentially opening up to domestic law enforcement agencies who didn't have it before. And we don't even know the first thing about who's being targeted under 12333.
Nate, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob.
Nate Cardozo is a senior staff attorney on the Electronic Frontier Foundation's Digital Civil Liberties team.
A final thought on Schadenfreude. It's been a go-to emotion for many in recent days.
Things are so bad in the inaugural planning that not one D.C. area marching band has applied to march in Trump's inauguration parade. And you know,
it's all very sad. Paul Anka and Jennifer Holliday also backed out. So far, the only celebrity who hasn't backed out of the inauguration is Donald Trump himself. But
even on Friday, New York Magazine, a bona fide member of the snarky set, among whom we must count ourselves, savored the new president's echo of the Batman villain, Bane.
Because today, we are not merely transferring power from one administration to another, or from one party to another, but we are transferring power from Washington, D.C., and giving it back to you, the people.
The oppressors of generations who have kept you down with myths of opportunity. And we give it back to you, the people.
Funny, but if we've learned anything this past year, it's that, though the most powerful man in the world is prickly, he's also impervious to jokes. In fact, they may make him stronger. I'm not calling out the comics, that's their job. But the American majority had better stop snickering, or the last laugh may be on us.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, and Jesse Brenneman. We had more help from Michael Loewinger, Sara Kari, Leah Feder, and Kate Bakhtiarova. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Terrence Bernardo.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Overbrook Foundation and the listeners of WNYC Radio.